Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Shireen Stanford. Sandra Charles is the Chief Medical Officer and Chief of Health Services for the Library of Congress, a position that combines her medical expertise with her passion for educating others. Her career has focused on internal medicine, occupational medicine, and the care of older adults. She's a wife, mother, grandmother, and native of Jamaica. She's also a member of Penn State's Outreach and Online Education Advisory Board. Dr. Charles, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I think it would come as a surprise to people. It was definitely a surprise to me that the Library of Congress would have a chief medical officer. Can you just talk about what it is that you do for the Library of Congress?
It being the world's largest library and a major institution of learning, it's also the repository of millions of collections, and those have to be processed, handled, put into the system so people may request them. So there's a lot of behind-the-scenes non-librarian work that occurs, and even for librarians, a lot of things have changed, and the cataloging these days is not the cards that many people may have been accustomed to. It's a lot of automated processes. And so with these various processes that occur, people need to may get injured, or they need to be assessed to make sure that they fit the job fits them and they fit the job. So part of our work in the health services division is to evaluate people who come in for employment in certain positions, usually the positions, materials handling type positions that require heavy lifting and have other physical requirements. And so that's part of what we do. But we also take care of the occupational wellness and general well-being for library employees, which is part of the fun of what we do, in that we produce programs, health promotion, and we produce a lot of programs on different topics, similar to what we'll probably be talking about each month. In fact, we had a major symposium on cancer with researchers and physicians from Georgetown University and NIH and other places, because we feel that in order to help people optimize their health, they not only need to know what's wrong with them and how to take care of it, but know what's on the coming up the pike, what's more there is. Give them hope, give them options. And so latest treatments, technologies, proton beam, that sort of thing, those are the things we bring to the library employees, as well as routine chronic medical illnesses that are known different than is in the general population.
So you're taking care of the health of the employees, but also doing educating and make sure that they kind of have best practices and information about health and wellness.
Precisely. And then we also serve, I do, in an advisory position to the management for things that may come up. We do a lot of medical emergency preparedness these days. And that is a major part of what we do as well. And then help people when they do need help, certain leave programs that are available to them through the regulations, help to facilitate their qualifying from a medical standpoint to participate in those programs.
And you mentioned that it's the largest library in the world.
Yes.
What's special about working at the Library of Congress?
Oh, my goodness. There's a lot of stuff special there. I remember the first time I went there for my interview, as a matter of fact, and just walking around, it's like a United Nations of ethnicities, different languages you hear spoken, the different exhibits that are there. Some of them are prominent as you even walk into the building. And just to know the buildings themselves tell their own story, because on Capitol Hill where I am, the oldest of the buildings, there are three buildings, and the oldest of is the Thomas Jefferson Building, which is over 100 years old. In fact, I think in 1997 we celebrated his 100th birthday. And the architecture, if you're a student of architecture, you're a student of different types of cultures, what have you. You see it all there. You walk around looking up in the ceiling at the frescoes and the different things that are carved there. You are in awe of the mahogany and the granite and the marble and how it all comes together. I would say to people, you go to Paris, you want to see Versailles, you come to Washington, D.C. and see the Library of Congress. And the other buildings also have their own interest. So the physical environment, the ambiance, and then just the breadth of knowledge and depth that's there. For example, one of the areas we collaborate with in producing our programs is the Science and Technology and Business Division. And they have librarians who are experts in science, in medicine. And the young lady with whom I work, she's a pharmacist, a geneticist, and she is a lecturer at Georgetown University. And so it's there's just so much to see and to do. And then there are the programs that they do, many different programs. So you're exposed to a lot of things, and you see and hear a lot of things. There are awesome visitors, different heads of state, members, particular groups, musical groups, and other artistic people. It's just a lot.
And you've been there for in this position for over 30 years.
Yes.
What do you think has kept you in this position for so long?
I have not been bored. And there's always something interesting to see and do. It's very rewarding working with the people that I work with. The employees, I learn so much from them, and there may be moments of frustration, but there's always something that occurs that says, that's why I do this. I remember one Thanksgiving getting this lovely basket, thank you basket. I'm like, what do I do now? And it was just someone whom I consulted with and advised on what to do from a medical issue, and she was quote-unquote thanking me for saving her life. Because of what it turned out to be and what we suspected. So, and we get lots of that, and it's very rewarding. You get a chance to help people see what's going on. You help them learn more about their illnesses, and you actually see people who have made the changes based on the interventions you do. Or you see the people who you had to refer out and realize that you actually did save their lives, and we have a lot of those. And that's basically what it's all about.
Okay. So let's go back a little bit. You know that immediately I could tell that you're from Jamaica.
Yes.
So can you talk about what it was like for you growing up in Kingston and just what your early life was like in Jamaica?
Wow. I mean, I come from a pretty large family. I was the oldest of eight. And for a while, it looked like it was all boys after me. And so at one point in time, it was decided that maybe I was getting to be too much of a tomboy. Actually, it was certainly after I walked into a wall playing blind man's buff and got a concussion. So I actually went to live with my grandmother, my mother's mother. And but still, you know, still kept close with all the rest of my family. And I guess I was always a bookish person. I was always reading. I was always in a book. Sort of got me out of a lot of housework, too, because I would be studying. So no one wanted to interrupt my studying, you know. And that is actually something that was heavily promoted by everyone, including my grandmother, that, you know, she would always say, get your education. She told me not to worry about boys or any of those things until I, quote, unquote, passed out, meaning I graduated.
Can you talk about your grandmother's influence on your education? How did she affect your drive and your goals?
She was the great motivator. That was, you know, that was her thing. You have to get your education. And she gave all that she had. She had what I think would have been equivalent to at best eighth grade education, comparatively speaking. But that didn't stop her. Every child, including my own children, who all came to knew her before they got to elementary school, was able to say their timetables and, of course, write, spell, and have the rudimentaries of reading, because that's what she did with you. And she wasn't pushy. She was a soft-spoken person. But she just drilled that into us that education was the key, and that we should do that. And it has influenced me, and it has influenced my children, her approach to education. And so that became a major platform for us as well.
So how did you know you wanted to be a doctor?
I guess, well, there are two things I wanted to be. It was a doctor and a teacher. And somehow I would, you know, kids, they nurse and doctor their dolls, and I would teach the plants. I always say.
So when you were young, you were actually playing the role of doctor to plants.
And to my dolls.
And to dolls.
And then I just remember there was something about how the respect that I had noticed doctors commanded. As I told you, when I was 7, I had a concussion running into the wall playing blind man's buff. And I saw how they operated in the hospital. Of course, it was all men. Nobody told me women couldn't do it, but it was all men. And I also remember when my brother had his appendix taken out. It was a simple exchange between them, but somehow it stuck in my head. You know, we were there, and the doctor came by, and my brother says to him, "Hello, Doc." And he goes, "Hello, Junior." And I go, I mean, at the time, I don't know exactly. It just stuck in my head. I'm not sure exactly what I thought or said, but somehow that interaction has stayed with me every time I think about the process. And as I went on, you know, my affinity for science, for Latin, I just felt it all, that's where it was leading, and kept pursuing it.
Did you come to the United States because your mom was here, or was it for your education? Or
both. When we came here, it was primarily for advancement and education.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Shireen Stanford. Our guest is Sandra Charles, Chief Medical Officer and Chief of Health Services for the Library of Congress. One of the things I know is important to you is talking about issues around mental health. Can you talk about why is mental health a topic that you think is important?
You know, that's a very good question. Simply because I didn't become a psychiatrist. I became an internist. And that was what appealed to me going through medical school. In fact, I clearly remember when it came to the mental health rotation, psychiatry rotation, I did an outpatient clinic and didn't have a lot of inpatient contact with patients. My first foray into the field, I would say, would be my undergraduate psychology classes. And there was just something disquieting reading about some of the illnesses. But after I finished my residency in internal medicine, I actually ended up working at the mental health hospital, St. Elizabeth's in Washington, D.C., initially because it was supposed to have taken care of a public health obligation that I had. And my first year there, I was responsible for a closed ward of geriatric patients, which is sort of what got me into my geriatric part of things. But I also noticed, you know, I observe everything and everyone, and I just noticed how those patients were, and it bothered me that we couldn't do more for them, and I started sort of delving more into what their issues were, what their diagnoses were, why they were the way they were. And for those patients, they were people who had come in when they were in their 20s. And we're now close to 100. There were actually a couple who were more than 100. And but I remember distinctly walking into that ward and walking around to see the unit and to see the patients, and it was just a cacophony of sounds. You couldn't make heads or tails. It was just sounds. But it sounded like very painful sounds. It sort of struck you as this is the sound of somebody who's in some deep emotional anguish. I would notice I would also try to reach out when you walk by. So I decided I would institute making rounds on the patients with the nurses and talk to them even though they couldn't talk back to me. And after a while, I realized that it actually made an impact because the sounds changed. And you could tell by the body language and some of the sounds that they were happy to have somebody paying them attention and talking to them. And so there would be times when the one person, say, would give you different types of feedback. And I would say things like, are you in pain? Does it hurt? Where does it hurt? And just reading through their records. And it just made such a difference. And then started making the connections with neurologic issues as well, because there's such a close interplay with psychiatry and neurology. And it made a deep impact on them and on me. So I started basically running like a little hospital within the ward and taking care of them. I was there for a total of 6.5 years. And over that 6.5 years, I was able to make such a difference in the lives of those patients and to better understand many aspects of mental illness. And then as I've worked both in all my other areas, I've come across people who I know and understand have these illnesses, and where I also realized that it was something didn't get spoken about. No one wanted to talk about what they had or how to deal with it or shirk it.
So, why do you think it's hard for us to talk about mental illnesses or mental health issues that we might be facing?
Because it's made out, whether in the media, movies, or just general growing up, that if you're quote-unquote mad, somehow that's something different than if you have high blood pressure or if you have diabetes or any acceptable medical illness. And I always remember the way cancer used to be spoken about, because I remember seeing people who would come and say, I have cancer, but I can't let my supervisor know because I lose my job or I might lose this or I might lose that. It's like, it's an illness. You didn't go and buy it or take it. It's something that occurs. And, of course, you can see nowadays people speak about it freely, which is helpful. It's helpful because then others will go and seek treatment. It's helpful because more money is put into research for the various cancers. And that's the way I'd like to see mental illness become. Mm-hmm. Just another spectrum of illnesses that need to be addressed, that people are willing and able to come forth and say what's going on with them. And more importantly, those around them are willing to understand what it means and to accept it and to work with them just as they would anyone else. Because we have to get past that stigma, and we have to get more care and more treatment and more access to care for people with mental illness.
I think about sleep patterns or things like that that are affecting our health, and things that we've kind of done, like with our cell phones, being on our phones. Why do you think it's so hard for us to maybe do some of the things that we know we should do to improve our health?
In terms of our lifestyle? Well, and that question is a whole lot encompassed. If I were to address sleep patterns and cell phones, we just had a lecturer talking about diurnal variations and impact of the cell phones and those little blue lights and green lights and affecting our melatonin secretion, which is what would help us to fall asleep, and the fact that how disrupted our sleep patterns are. And actually his parting, one of his parting notes was the fact that melatonin, that being suppressed, actually leaves us open to developing serious illnesses, including cancers. And so he was talking about how concerned he was for little kids who are always on the tablets and the iPads and the phones. and our general life. You know, we've had all kinds of age of mechanism, you know, what have you. Now we're in the age of technology, and everything is, there's nothing that shuts down anymore. And so there's more shift work, and then people who work shift work. Our bodies are no longer sleep at night, work in the daytime. They have shifts that cross day and night, and you have days and you have nights, and then you have people who do doubled and what have you. And so all of those things are playing, have a large impact on what we do, some of which we can't control. Now, the things that we can control, I think for the most part, a lot of people don't want to look beyond tomorrow. Well, I didn't see anything happening to me because I didn't eat this. I don't see anything happening because I didn't sleep, what have you. So the looking long term and trying to change lifestyle, which is part of what we try to do in our health promotion work and wellness. But unfortunately, a lot of people don't make that decision until either they and or a member of their family gets struck unexpectedly, in their minds at any rate, by a stroke or a heart attack, or learn they have diabetes. You know, that in itself has become an epidemic.
In those times when you are able to help people to make those interventions or change mm-hmm. to have a healthier lifestyle, have you been able to see a difference?
Yes, we have. Because for a long time, you know, this career of mine, we were having lectures, you know. So this month is Heart Disease Month. This month is Mental Health Month. This month is prostate cancer. We would just be doing, we would bring in speakers, or we would be the speakers talking about it. And then we started working with a very passionate employee advocate who had seen her own share of illness and was always very passionate about lifestyle and wellness. And she had a connection directly with people. And so we would do roundtable discussions, and we would have people be the presenters. And, you know, when you listen to your peers, it makes a bigger impact sometimes. And then we would be there as the subject matter experts who would then explain a particular symptom or constellation of symptoms that somebody had. And so that helped them to make a better connection. And we've had people who have made some dramatic changes. And so, as I mentioned earlier in the interview, that's one of the rewarding things about doing health promotion and wellness, because then you really start seeing how people change and modify them. And then there are those who don't. And we still try because, you know, sometimes it's timing. Sometimes there has to be some seminal event that helps somebody to decide to make a change.
For you, I mean, you've known from a very young age that you wanted to be a doctor. Were there any challenges being a woman or being Black, being an immigrant in this country, to reaching that career goal?
Yes. Starting with undergraduate, when I went to college, I was one of the first group of African American students who actually were on that college campus. And we would have professors who would say, they would question why you were there. And then if they weren't doing that, they would assume that everyone was a political science major. And so when you became as a science major, pre-med, it was like, I've never seen this before. Why are there so many people along here? And I said, I can't speak for anyone else, but I know for me, this is what I want to do. This is my path that I'm pursuing. And, you know, some of the professors, especially those who sincerely inquired as to the why, would be helpful and help facilitate your learning. And then the others would say, you will not get more than a C in this class, or you won't get more than whatever. And then there's one incident in terms of being a woman that I found most egregious, and that was in my physics lab. And I'm a very particular person, and I have a little bit of OCD and all of those things. And so, you know, you had to, in the lab, have to have your book well documented and what have you. And we were working in groups of three. It was two guys and myself. And so, and I was the one doing the log, making sure everything was properly captured and what have you. And then we turned the log in, and they got A's, and I didn't. And I was, to say I was not happy is an understatement. And I challenged it because it felt so unfair. And his reason was, which he freely gave, he thought the man had done the work and I was just coasting along as a woman, you know, what the heck was I doing in physics anyway? So, you know, so there were a few of those things. But despite... And there were other assumptions made and other slights, if you may, and undertones. But I knew what I wanted to do. I knew I was going to do it. And so I just plodded on and ignored a lot of things that came my way. It had an impact on where I ended up going to school because I was fortunate to have been accepted into several schools in the New York area. But I decided after having gone to college in the one majority, I thought I would do medical school at Howard University, which is a predominantly black institution.
And what about, obviously your career is one part of you. What are some other things that you think are core to who you are as a person?
Well, just as a person, I think I'm a volunteer. I have a volunteer spirit, so to speak. Over the years, I have been on boards for retirement communities. I have been on board national boards for aging, and all these have piqued my interest. I have one of those. I want to speak. I think you never stop learning. I advise my students, my employees. You never turn down education. You never turn on opportunities for learning, and you go where it leads you, even if that's not your field. Because people would say, well, how is it that you're doing this when you're a doctor? Is it learning? Is it a field that I can help someone in or I can learn something from? I do it.
Dr. Charles, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Hope I have contributed to your program and educating your audience. I've enjoyed this. Thank you.
Sandra Charles is the Chief Medical Officer and Chief of Health Services for the Library of Congress, a position that combines her medical expertise with her passion for educating others. Her career has focused on internal medicine, occupational medicine, and the care of older adults. Hear more Take Note interviews on our website at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Shireen Stanford, WPSU.